Testing, testing, 1, 2, 3. How does that sound?
Good, you're good. Sounds great.
Okay.
All right. The Amazon Games promo, take one.
In a world
where a hybrid breed of mutant male savages are feeding on the barren lands of Mother Earth.
A time where mankind has been replaced by womankind.
A battle of epic strength will collapse a barbaric enemy.
One woman
dare to rise up and exceed the boundaries of the impossible. From the literary phenomenon that inspired a generation comes a quadrilogy
of one brave warrior who must fight for her land.
From BAFTA-winning director Terrence Pouncer, the Amazon Games.
It's a broad new world.
Whoa.
I cannot wait to see that movie.
Hello and welcome to The Last Laugh. I'm Matt Wilstein from The Daily Beast. Today on the show, Blake Bell. The clip you just heard is from her 2013 directorial debut, In a World, a movie that I love. I've been a big fan of Lake's since she starred in Children's Hospital on Adult Swim and the very underrated How to Make It in America on HBO. Now she has co-created the new show Bless This Mess, which just started its second season last month on ABC. Lake and her co-star Dax Shepard play a married couple who decide to give up their busy lives in New York City and move to a farm in Nebraska. It's a surprisingly funny and nuanced show, especially for network TV, something we talked a lot about in this episode. You're also going to want to stick around till the end of the podcast for a great story about what happened on Lake's first day of shooting the movie It's Complicated when she had to act opposite Meryl Streep. If you like this podcast, we need your help. Please go to Apple Podcasts and leave us a rating and review and tell us how you like the show so far. But now my conversation with Lake Bell. I can hear you.
Okay, great.
Cool. Well, thanks for coming in and doing this today.
Yeah, listen.
Are you based out here or are you in New York?
I born and raised in New York, but yeah. I'm based here. So yeah. I've been back and forth, but yeah, I live here. Yeah. I think it's imperative with kids to live somewhere where you don't have to sort of like trudge through sleet, like pee stained sleet in order to get from A to B. So
yeah.
But I was born and raised in New York. I don't know how my parents did it, but they don't.
Yeah, I don't know how people raise kids in New York. It's crazy.
Yeah, it's cool. You know what I mean? I feel like you wear like a badge. You have to tell everybody.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because you need credit for doing it. And I give mad props to my friends who do it.
Mm-hmm.
One of my best friends since I was 15 lives out there and has 4 kids and lives in Brooklyn. And I'm just like, you know, she was kind of like my mom mentor. I was like, you're doing something right. And she had like all home birth, so I was like, I'm doing home birth, you know. And then I was like, Jesus Christ. That was a choice. I'm very happy here. I think my husband too was kind of like, well, you can, you know, he's an artist.
And is he a New York guy too?
He's from Louisiana. He's from like the bayou of Louisiana.
Oh, okay.
So he's like has wrestled an alligator before, you know, like without hyperbole. I remember meeting him and I was like, oh, we have like zero background in common.
Yeah.
I was like the Upper East Side and, you know, my mom was like, be a debutante. And he was like, I'm going to swim in oil infested gator waters, you know. I was like, but that's what's cool, right?
You're so like, he likes it out here too?
He loves it, yeah. It's like, you know, he can have an art space, you know, he can have his tattoo shop, he can dabble in all kinds of things in the same way that you can in New York, but with square footage.
yeah. Is it true that you met your husband on How to Make It in America?
Yes.
Yeah. I loved that show,
that
by
show,
the way.
Thank you. That it's funny. There's been like a research. I don't know if it's like playing somewhere, but there's definitely like this little.
I feel like it's pretty underrated. It's like under the radar.
Yeah. It was kind of, it was like the New York show before Girls. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like we met there. He came on. Basically, the show kind of populated its guest stars and whatnot with authentic New York characters and figures, you know, so that are participating in the cultural kind of, you know, tapestry of New York at that time, you know? And so, for instance, instead of getting, you know, my character gets a tattoo and, you know, they're like, instead of getting an actor to play a tattoo artist, let's get like that guy, Scott Campbell, you know? So I was like, great.
The tattoo artist
of New York City at, you know, whatever. And his industry, he's like, you know, fucking
big deal.
He's big deal McGillicuddy. You know what I mean? I didn't have any tattoos. So I didn't know anyone or anything about that industry. But I was like, great. Sounds awesome. Like, get that guy.
How did he give you a fake tattoo on camera? Did he know how to do that? Or was that like,
yeah. So he had been like the guy that people went to, like Harmony Korine would go to him, you know, for what's it called? The Spring Breakers, you know, like for all those tattoos on James. You know, he had been, he does transfers all the time, for movies. So, you know, he, I guess he was very used to it. I think what you had to do is first you had to draw it on. So, you know, to kind of show the producers like, this is what it'll look like before I make transfers, you know?
Yeah.
And so, he drew it. I remember like, I mean, do you want to hear? I was like, kind of like dorky romantic story, but basically I saw him in the trailer at like 6 a.m., you know, because I kept hearing about this guy, Scott Campbell, and the producers, which are all a bunch of dudes. It was like all the same kind of entourage guys. Great sort of fun team to work with, but holy moly. but I love Ian. Ian Edelman and I got along really well. He is the creator of the show. And Ian was like, I really think you should get the tattoo like kind of somewhere hidden, you know, like by your fucking what, you know, like on your hip or something, because then you don't have to deal with hair and makeup every day. You know what I mean? That means you come in an hour earlier to like put it on, because then you get, you know, I was like, I think it should be on the arm. Like, well, I want to live vicariously through my character and have a tattoo for once. And it was of pancakes and syrup, so it wasn't even like a super hot, sexy tattoo. It was just like pancakes and syrup, which is kind of hot and sexy. I mean, it's hot, at least and melty, you know. Butter's sexy in its own way. But anyway, so anyway, I walked in and I knew he had to draw it on, and I saw Scott, and I was like, holy shit. I was like, let me hear more about this. All of a sudden, because I'm very like, I'm one of the guys, like, talk to me, you know. And all of a sudden, I was like, hey. Like, I was just like, lost the plot a little bit. And he was like, hey, so I got to like draw this on you. Like, where are we going to put it? And I was like, oh. And I let go all of my sort of big kind of idea of having it, you know, somewhere visible. And I was like, well, the producers want it on my hip, you know, which is like kind of sexy. Sorry, you know, whatever. And so I got like the super smoking hot guy to learn, you know, fucking draw like on my hip, and it was hot. And I was like, I don't know, I was gonna like marry him and like give, but you know, to have children with, make humans with him, but it did. But yeah, so it was kind of
that's a great story.
You know, there's a lot of other details too, but but mostly, I remember he actually, we both were kind of like, I wasn't dating anyone, but he was, and so of course, I don't, you don't meet someone and go, hi, nice to meet you, I'm dating someone, you know, so I didn't know that initially, and I just remember being like, he was very honorable. I don't think he knew I was like throwing shit at him at initially. Everything was very platonic, you know,
and professional.
And you know, I and he was like, oh, I'm going to, he basically was like, I can do that, I'm gonna draw this tattoo on, and then I'm gonna get on a plane to go to Russia to run a marathon. And we were like,
okay,
that is not the thing that I hear a lot of people say about what their plans are, you know. And so everyone in the makeup trailer, we were all like, oh, we're going to have to give evidence of this, right? And I was like trying to get, I was like, not me only, but like all of us together. Yeah. So we should probably, someone should get his email just for like pictorial evidence. I'll do it. I'll give you my email. I'll give you my email. And then we could just like platonically like email about this thing. And this was still, I did not know he was dating anyone. Anyway, the point is, I then found out and I was like, oh shit, like walked way back. Even though I was very like, thank you for your aforementioned photograph that you, you know, but he did send me a photograph of him just at the finish line in a Russian marathon.
And then how long between that and you guys actually getting together?
It was like 2 months or something, you know, because he, you know, I was like, hey, man, like, I think I emailed him, super awkward, but I was like very, I was like in therapy. I was like, hey, I was like, he might think I'm crazy, but whatever. I was like, I think I'm too excited to see your, like, your name in my inbox. So in a platonic way, I'd like to cut ties from all of our correspondence.
You were breaking up with him.
Yeah, yeah, even though we would not, you know, and I was like, I respect your relationship. I think I am too interested in your correspondence, so I am bowing out. And I was like, so I'll see you around. And if you ever find yourself solo, you know, I'd love to buy me a steak dinner. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so he was like, oh, wow, that's, I don't know how to respond to an email that says, mm-hmm. don't respond to me, you know. Yeah. And, yeah. But he respected that and we went separate ways. And then 2 months later, he was like, I'd like to buy you a steak.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's great. So now you're out here, you're making Bless This Mess.
Yes.
Good transition,
sexy
right?
Sexy pivot. Okay. Yeah, I'm here.
And,
I'm doing it.
So I want to talk about the show because you created it with Liz Merriweather,
yes,
right?
Yes, yeah.
How did you meet her? How long have you known her?
I knew her. We did a movie called Fuck Buddies together, which was widely known as No Strings Attached, but I prefer the original title.
She was a writer on that movie?
She wrote that, mm-hmm. that screenplay. And I was in it and played a version of her in it, sort of a... I mean, you know, it was just deeply funny character that I was really obsessed with that had this sort of wonderful, like, motor mouth neuroses and, like, would backtrack on things she said, but, like, still, like, somewhat quasi-powerful at the same time. So it was, like, a really interesting character, and I always was, like, very connected with Liz because I loved the voice of the way she wrote this person, and we became friends. And then, and that was a movie that Ashton Kutcher and Natalie Portman was in, just to remind everyone, and Greta Gerwig and whatnot. And Jake Johnson was actually in that. And so obviously he ended up in New Girl.
Yeah, yeah.
And I came on, I like stayed friends with Liz and we just never really worked together. I did it like a New Girl or once, but it wasn't like we were working together. I was doing my stuff. And then after doing two indie movies and like having two babies, you know, I sort of knew New Girl was like coming to an end. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, if I ever was going to do TV, I'd want to do it with her, you know, because she was just like a master or a mistress of network television. And I was sort of interested in network television because it was the antithesis of what I had been doing. And I wanted to, I was like, oh, okay, when you make indie movies, you have such a small audience, which is not bad. It's just like, I've done that twice. And I was like, okay, that's very cool. And I would love to bring a sort of that kind of subtle or, you know, my own sensibility to a larger audience and see how that fares and see if it's possible. You know what I mean? So it's not like, oh, you know, network comedy only can be a certain type of comedy. I was like, I'm just curious.
And New Girl was kind of an example of that for you maybe?
Yeah. Or? I mean, New Girl was really funny. It was really cool. Yeah. It was in the voice of, you know, Liz and her amazing writers. And I felt like, it was appealing to a wide audience, but it also had something like very original and quirky and allowed you to still be really silly, but also grounded, you know?
Yeah.
And I strive to do that with Bless This Mess, but then I wanted to add my sort of like visual and tonal stamp on it. So, you know, I was like, hey, Liz, let's, you know, would you want to do that? And she was like, I've been waiting for you to call, you know? And then we sat on a couch and we like started spitballing ideas, and there was a myriad of things we wanted to do, but we kept circling back to just we'd both been somewhat newly married or at least young in our marriage, and so that's where the most fodder for comedy sort of kept gestating, you know. It was like out of the relationship stuff, right? Like, what's excruciating about being in a relationship and peeling back the onion? And what's excruciating about, you know, learning about someone that you love and the things that you loved about them now all of a sudden are the things that you're like, oh my God, oh, we're together forever. Okay. You know, it's like, that's really interesting, but we didn't want to write something that was bickery. We don't want to see people fucking fighting. You know what I mean? It was definitely, we wanted to put it in a place of idealism, or rather optimism, I should say. And so it's like optimism, but also realism. So it's like those two things, right? So, you can play within that and be really silly, but in a deeply grounded place. And it can be visually very beautiful. Mm-hmm. Like I, you know, every day on set, I'm like, all right, let's like, continue to challenge ourselves to not be like, well, we got to move so fast. It doesn't matter if the wide doesn't look pretty. I'm like, let's just make the wide look beautiful, you know?
Yeah.
Because we have this gorgeous, we shoot everything exterior. And the concept of like this couple, this new age couple, you know, who are very like New Yorker-y, you know, we've got your neuroses represented by my character, which is like, you know, I'm like the Jewish New Yorker who like, you know, really does things a certain way, but then prides herself on like her street smarts, you know, she thinks that'll really come in handy on a farm. And like, you know, then Dax's character is like this kind of, he's like, you know, he grew up out there. He got left this farm. And
Dax Shepard.
Dax Shepard plays Mike, who's kind of like, you know, he took summers out there with his family. And, you know, he's from the suburbs of St. Louis. So he fancies himself as capable. But of course, he's been like a freelance music journalist in the city for a very long time and wears tight jeans and, you know, applies lip balm occasionally, you know, so they're both sort of ill-equipped, but with great hope and a lot of sort of optimism to take on this new and this like beautiful kind of simpler life that offers air, you know, fresh air. And, you know, they've been cooped up in a basement apartment and suffering through New York because it's kind of what you're like taught. I don't know. They grew up thinking that's the end goal, but they're like, well, we don't have to do that. Let's own a plot of dirt. Let's
Does that come out of, you know, a desire on your part to kind of get out of the grind of city life?
I mean, absolutely. That's when Liz and I kept talking about it. I was like, oh man, I just keep coming back to this idea of, my husband, the Louisiana Bayou man, is, you know, he's very capable and he's a prepper. And like he always is like, we need to have a plot of land. We need to have paper maps in case, you know, the shit hits the fan. And like we got it, you know, he's got bug out bags and the whole thing. Like you don't even know the half of it. But he's got like ham radio, you know, he's like he's prepared.
Yeah.
And I think about, First of all, I'm very grateful that I'm married to him because I feel like if the shit does hit the fan, like
you're gonna be in good shape.
Yeah. Like he's got it under control. But yeah, I think he and I do dream about and daily talk about, I mean, seriously, definitely weekly, but almost daily talk about like, well, where would we go and what would we do? And how, you know, there's a lot of fantasy in and around the idea of like, could we just, like, could home base be on a plot of dirt where we could just not have to be so immersed in technology? I think there is a mass exodus, even just of you know, families going from urban environments to more rural environments, or even you've got your Brooklynites coming out to LA because they just want more nature or whatever it is, right? Like we're so inundated with, I mean, obviously me, I rev at a high RPM. You know what I mean? Even just, I feel like I'm talking so much. I apologize. I did have an espresso. But, you know, I think that is, you know, we're folded in, we're sewn into this kind of existence of moving very quickly. And it's what we're ingesting. It's cultural, you know?
Yeah.
And so I think the natural evolution of that is to crave like a slower pace and a sort of more grounded existence in something that feels much more real, which is just, you know, the planet, the earth, you know, dirt, whatever, right? Yeah.
Oh my gosh, there's there must be neighbors. There's people just like walking up to just like say hi and welcome us. What should I say?
Okay, so just start with hi. Okay. And then just kind of let it evolve from there.
Yeah, just like.
She was born and raised in New York. She's never said hi to a neighbor. This is so fantastic. I'm so glad you're here for this.
Come on in!
Oh. Hi! I'm Kay Bowman. Oh,
hi. I'm Paul Bowman, their son Jacob.
I am their son Jacob.
Hi.
Oh, Kay. Young Jacob.
Rudy. Can I offer you guys something? We don't have much, but we have a little biscotti and some unsweetened ginger beer.
Vinspan noodles.
Also like a turmeric cracker.
The red are gluten-free, as I recall.
There's I think an ashwagandha hot drink.
Anything jumping out at you?
You also work with a lot of animals on the show.
Yes.
Do you regret
that decision?
That decision to include so many animals?
We have no babies on the show.
That's true.
So we're all animals.
But, you know, they could at the future of the show. You never know what's going to happen.
Don't even get me started. No, I'm just kidding. But I think, I'm like, are you pitching me right now?
Yeah. So season three, they have a baby.
Season five.
Home birth.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, Jesus. I have a lot to say on that. But the animals on the show... We have a lot of animals, and which it's sort of like, how did I end up? Liz and I are always like, how did we end up in a situation where the email inbox is like goat on a waterbed, you know, side boob and snakes, like where it's just literally like the weirdest emails I've ever encountered. But yeah, we are constantly dealing with animals, and it's kind of fun. I mean, part of the reason that Liz and I were excited about it, I mean, she grew up in Michigan. I grew up always like, I'm the kid who got bitten by dogs all the time because I would just go up and snuggle dogs that were like, hey, buddy, like, cool it, you know? Mm-hmm. And I kept going back, you know? I'm obsessed with animals. Like, I love animals. I am interested in, I love people too, but I think animals are kind of better than people. And I, you know, it is a really fun part of the job that I get to like snuggle with piglets and like, yes, I'm executive producing and like directing and doing all that jazz, but I get to snuggle with piglets and that is fun. And I feed little baby lambs on the set. I mean, it's like we have a llama named Rosie, you know.
Does Dax enjoy the animals as much as you do? Or?
Dax is like... Look, he's a good sport. It's a lot. He's good. I don't think he's at the level that I am. I know his wife is also an animal lover, so I think he's used to having ladies around him who are fawning over all kinds of animals.
I mean, as you said, you set out to make a show about new marriage, and I think there are really interesting conversations in the show about that, you know, first few couple years of marriage and frank conversations about sex and relationships and all that. I mean, and that's something that I think in a rare way for network TV, which is cool.
Did you see episode two?
Yeah, is what I'm thinking about.
Yeah.
So maybe talk about that episode.
Yeah.
Like where did that come from and why did you want to do that?
It was, I say almost every day to my writer group, I'm just like, it's important that, you know, among this silliness and among our fun shenanigans and, animal ridiculousness and goats on waterbed, that at the core of everything, you know, it's like we have to talk about real things, right? Mm-hmm. So I feel like I'm in it for that. I think, you know, episode two, which we're referring to, is called Phase Two. And it's an episode about sex and relationships when, you know, you're cresting on the second year of your marriage. And, you know, the first year was very romantic and a lot of sex all the time. And then, like, well, what happens? Like, what is that? Is that like a plateau? Is that acclimatizing? Like, why, you know, and then just talking about priority is shifting. And then that's okay. You know, of course, my character is a therapist, so she's very, like, interested in the, you know, human condition, as am I. I would totally be a therapist if I wasn't an actor. In a way I feel like I am to myself. But yeah, so I think this episode was really, really fun because very grounded, and even like the stuff between Bo and Kay, aka Lennon Parham and David Koechner, who are ace comedians, and I hope you talk to them as well.
Yeah.
I feel like you should get them in together.
That'd be great.
Jesus Christ, they are funny.
Yeah.
Lennon. Lennon says stuff, and she's like the only person who will make me really, really break. Mm-hmm. Like. She works with JT, who's a lot her son in it, and he just I'm not like outing JT as someone who breaks, but he would say it himself too.
He can't keep it together.
It's virtually it's very hard. His job is very hard because he has Koechner and Lennon as his parents, and they are just like lobbing out comedy gold left and right. So, but anyway. The two of them also have incredibly beautiful, raw, real stuff that's just good, like smack dab at 8:30 on ABC, you know what I mean, on a Tuesday night. So it's kind of, it's cool. It's an opportunity to be real and, you know, cloak true, raw, real emotion and some cultural politics in a show that has some hijinks and some shenanigans and it's shenanigans and kind of allows us to reach a broader audience with that kind of sort of cultural conversation.
My God, when was the last time you two had sex?
What? It's none of your business.
We're roommates.
No, we're not roommates. You are temporarily staying here because you are separated from your wife.
Whatever it is, I've got a front row seat to your marriage, and I'd like to give you some feedback.
Oh, well, I have some feedback for you. We don't want your feedback.
Yes.
What, have you guys been married almost 2 years?
2 years, yeah.
So honeymoon over. Now you're into phase two.
Really? How many phases are there?
That's it. Phase two, then death.
Bo, I'm a licensed therapist, and I can assure you that Mike and I, we have a communicative, very healthy relationship.
You two haven't lain together in 3 weeks.
You're counting?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's not appropriate.
It's also, like, not accurate.
I just don't want you two to become me, staying in your idiot neighbor's house while all your stuff gets dropped off on a pallet in the front yard.
Yeah, I also want to give a shout out to Ed Begley Jr., who is so funny on this show.
He is so when we do read-throughs, every week with the episode that we're going to shoot the next week. And it's just kind of insane how he slays at those. Like, he knows to pause like a motherfucker. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like he knows exactly where the comedy is within the silence. Like, he also it's like, the best comedy, right, is exercising restraint, right? Mm-hmm. I've told myself throughout my career, because I can be a total maniac spaz. Mm-hmm. And, you know, all I always tell myself, it's like my mantra is like exercise restraint. Even in writing, you know, it's like I can, you know, I'm always like the things that I like and I gravitate to, and when I pat myself on the back is when I put all the things that I thought were funny out there and then I restrain, you know? So he does that so gracefully and so instinctually, and he has, yes, been around a long time and has, you know, just the most phenomenal career on his sort of IMDb page, and so he has that experience. But this character is quite unique for him, and he gets to be as dry as possible, and he was the first person we met with for Rudy. Yeah, we were like, oh my God, Ed Begley Jr., like, he's going to come and meet us, you know? And so he came in. And in the way that he presented himself, we were just like, well, there's no point in meeting anyone else, but we have to, I mean, we can't not, but it's done, you know? Yeah. Same with Dax. We were like, let's just write it for like a Dax Shepard type, you know what I mean? Because it's like sweet and funny and like, you know, he can like do all the stuff. He's like good looking, you know, let's just write it. And then of course we just were like, should we also offer it to him? Like, see if he'll just do it? Because that would be really easy just from a writing standpoint. Yeah. So,
had you known him before?
I did, just from like preschool drop-offs. He says that we met at some like fancy party or something 100 years ago. I don't maybe I was inebriated. I don't know. We were like waiting online to go to the bathroom. I sort of remember it, but I don't know. Mm. You know, it was like I really know him more from like being at preschool, dropping off and being like, hey, you're the other actor, what's up? You know, like, hey, good to see you. Yeah. And he's also into cars, you know, so I'd be like, hey, man, what do you got going on there? Is that a, you know, it's just like we had something in common in that he's married to a Belle, you know, it was like, yeah, I like that name too. And you know, I was like, it was natural that it worked, and it did. And Koechner, I knew. I did a movie with Koechner 100 years ago called Good Old Fashioned Orgy. It was like a bunch of comedy folks over in Wilmington, North Carolina. And that was a really funny movie that we did, and I remembered him from that and everything he does. He makes me laugh. And so Lennon funny. I knew personally. I tend to just want to work with people that I know and that I love, because it is a great privilege, right? You're just kind of like, well, I mean, there's only so many hours in the day. If I could just hang out with the people that I love. I want to give great credit though too to like the writers of the show, because we have an incredible group of people, and that is a new experience for me, because when you're writing indies, obviously you're alone in a room.
Yeah.
And then this beautiful, magical experience of having this like team of creative people that you've curated all in the same room and sharing like sharing stories and slugging it out together. That's very cool.
Mm-hmm. Coming up, Lake talks about how she got started as a serious actor, but really found her voice when she got the opportunity to be funny on screen. So I want to go back a little bit and talk about, you know, sort of how you got to where you are now. And since this is a comedy podcast, I mean, what were you always interested in doing comedy? Or when you started, what kind of actor, when you started thinking that you wanted to be an actor, what kind of stuff did you want to do?
I mean, the start for me was, you know, my parents are always annoyed when I talk about this, but my parents are divorced and they got divorced really young. And then mm-hmm. that became like my brother and I were like best friends, you know, mm-hmm. and because we were like, oh, my God, this shit is crazy. Like, mm-hmm. let's just fucking yeah. team up and let them be weird. And it was, you know, I feel like that's where I first started being like, OK, I actually have this like really interesting defense mechanism, mm-hmm. this sort of that can kind of, you know, shake up the room a little bit if I'm like goofy or funny or make a joke or, mm-hmm. you know, entertain or something. So I had something called the Late Lake Show, which was really a procrastination tool before bed or whatever. But that was like the first time I was like, OK, I like making people laugh. Mm-hmm.
And this was performed for your brother or for
the family, for anybody yeah. who was over, mm-hmm. whatever. It was like, OK, Lake, it's time to go to bed. And I'd be like, wait a minute, because Late Lake Show starting now, you know. And then I'd be like, you know, and then it would just be like, the first character is, you know, and I would just like go into a thing and be like, hey, can I get that shawl of yours, Mrs. Rolex? You know, and it would just go into it. So that started at like six, I think, or like four, you know, from 4 to 6. And then, yeah, anyway, so that was, I remember being like, ooh, I like that thing that you make people laugh and it's fun and it's, and I'm addicted to it. And then, but I knew I wanted to be an actor. So then it was like, I went to drama school. My mom was like, if you're going to be an actor, if you're going to be an actor, you have to like study in England. And so, I was like, God damn it. Can't I just go out to L.A. and like do the thing? I don't know, like get a push up bra and fucking like do like audition for Felicity, you know?
Is that what you wanted to do?
I don't know. I just thought like that was a way to start. Mm-hmm. And then you could just like fucking get to a place where people paid attention to you, and then you could do whatever you want. You know, mm-hmm. it was like,
yeah,
but it was a different time. You know, you're just like, can't you just like make a splash by being like, hey, you know, like mm-hmm. and then you're like, all right, I actually have something to say.
Yeah.
But of course, now hopefully it won't have to be that way. But yeah. I literally went to drama school for a year. And then had a summer in LA. I was like, oh shit, you know, I got a lead on like a, you know, an advice from, I got advice from like a manager, this amazing woman who like allowed me to come out there and, you know, sent me on some auditions. And sure enough, you know, she was like, put a push-up bra and go audition for Felicity. I did get a call back. I did not get the role. But I remember her saying to me, you know, she was like, yeah, because I did start to get into the like drama school thing, which is like, you are a blank canvas, right? Like you wear all black and you neutralize your voice. And of course, neutralizing your voice in England is like received pronunciation, which is RP, which is not neutral in this town. But anyway, so there was this whole, like, I remember going to auditions in all black and being like, no makeup, blank canvas. Like, I got obsessed with that.
And that's not necessarily what they were looking for.
It does not work in LA. And she literally was like, you have to wear like a ton of mascara and like get your shit together and look gorgeous. I was like, well, what if I'm playing like, you know, the victim, like a widow or something? They're like, yeah, you need to look gorgeous.
They want a gorgeous widow.
Yeah, you got to be. And I was like, but she's supposed to be haggard and she's like an addict. Gorgeous widow, haggard addict. I was like, I am so confused right now. You know, so anyway, that was a different time.
Was that frustrating?
I mean, it was like, I just was like, this is hilarious. You know, I was just like doing it, you know, and I felt like I say it was really a different time because it really was like that kind of concept is not anymore, in my opinion. Like, I would feel that would be weird if you went in as a, you know.
Yeah. But do you think that young actors are still getting that same advice?
I don't know. I think that for TV, there was this concept that, like, everyone had to be beautiful all the time, right? And I don't think TV is like that anymore. Yeah. I think it's like, you can be real. You should look like a person, you know? And certainly when I cast as a director, I'm like, I am very turned off by when people come in looking like a model, but male or female. I'm like, what is that? Like, who can, you know? So anyway, I ended up doing a bunch of drama stuff because I was coming out of drama school and I was like conservatory trained, and that, you know, I had been in the machine of that. And then everyone was like, couldn't get a comedy audition. And then I got Mismatch was kind of like one of my first comedy bits, which was like this show with it was a Darren Star show. I played like the brunette best friend to Alicia Silverstone, and I was super slutty and like the butt of most comedy.
This is post Clueless,
Yes. Yeah. And I was and that was great. I was all of a sudden like, hello, like I want to make fun of. I'll be whatever, like booby or whatever, but I'm gonna fucking ridiculous.
Was that the first time that you felt like you really got to be funny on screen, or is there something else that, that
for sure? That? I mean, that was like. That was the first time that I, you know, day in, day out, like my job was to be the comedic, you know, she, you know, Alicia, who I'm still friends with, she was sort of like more of the straight woman. And like I got to be like the funny best friend, which I, you know, I had done. There was like indie movies there where they would give me the audition for the girl, you know, and I was like, I'm just gravitating towards the wacky best friend. You know, I was like, can I just audition for that? They're like, yeah, but that's not the, you know.
Yeah.
So I think I just like wanted, I thought it was more interesting. I was like, I want to see a movie about the wacky best friend. Like, I'm sorry. Can we just see that movie?
I think you've played a lot of wacky best friends.
Totally. I mean, shit. I was loved it. You know, it was so fun. And then like, yeah, What Happens in Vegas was like a really big turn for me, I think. Because I met one of my, I met a lot of my best friends there. Like Rob Corddry, Cameron Diaz. It was like, that was a huge deal, and it was like a big movie. You know, it was a big movie for me. So, and that was like, hey, this is a comedy person, you know. And then Corddry and I, obviously, he asked me to do Children's Hospital, and then I was kind of off to the races a little bit.
Yeah, Children's Hospital seems like it was a big turning point for your career in terms of getting into that comedy world, and that's such like a comedy person show.
I know. And it's,
and so many great guest stars and just people that have been on it. And then you ended up directing on that show too. So was that some of the first directing that you did, or how did that happen?
But you're right. Yeah, it was an amazing, like I felt really lucky to be kind of asked to get into that world. And it really just, it genuinely made me happy. It was like a first, like, oh, I choose life. You know, it was, you know, doing comedy is genuinely fun. And and making people laugh and enjoy themselves that way was really fun, and especially with Children's Hospital, which is so absurdist. You know, there's no logic, and that was really satisfying. You know, while in dramas is so logical. You know, and it's like, well, you can't do this, you can't say that, and we could do anything. Yeah,
no rules on Children's Hospital.
No, none.
But we all have brains, and brains are messy things filled with jelly. And although jelly is sweet, it made me do a silly thing.
I broke up with Glenn.
What? Why? He's the hottest doctor at Children's.
I just can't imagine spending every Christmas with a Jew, you know? Lighting candles all the time, telling knock-knock jokes.
Totally. Driving minivans, reading books.
Right?
I'm gonna break up with Owen.
Why?
Well, you broke up with Glenn. We're roommates. That would be totally confusing.
Right. How are you gonna do it?
I don't know. I need to think of a good lie. Ah, I wish you were Jewish.
And so that tight-knit, we became very tight-knit too. So what happened was I ended up, I felt very empowered, I think. I felt very, you know, comfortable in my skin and in what I was doing. And then I started, I had been writing like in a closet fashion for many years. I had a myriad of other things that had been in different states of development. Like I had a dramedy script that I had written with this other woman that I had set up with fancy producers and had like Christopher Walken attached. I had like, I had other things percolating in my early 20s, but they would dissipate because I lost financing or there was a problem or, you know?
Yeah.
And so I'd been writing forever, but I never thought to direct until, quote, later when I got older or something, right? And then I had written In a World, and I wrote In a World when I was shooting What Happens in Vegas. I'm sorry, when I was shooting How to Make It in America, because I was just in that show. I wasn't like directing or producing or anything,
so
I just had
time.
A lot of time, and it was a creative space. And so I had presented that to my agents. I was like, you know, I really want to make this movie. I want to star in this movie. I want to produce it. And they're like, well, let's shop for directors. I was like, great, let's shop for... I was like...
Were you thinking that you wanted to direct it at that point?
I didn't know. I just was like, that's a lot. I had never directed before. And I was like, it was that thing of like, I respect the process. I've never done it before. And with all due respect, like, I don't want to direct until I've directed. Mm-hmm. And then my agent was like, well, it doesn't work like that. And he's like, why don't you write a short film and direct that? Mm-hmm. And so I was like, that's a fucking genius idea. I went home that night and was like, bah, 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 and yeah. like pounded out this short film that I had an idea for mm-hmm. called Worst Enemy.
Yeah.
And I invested in myself. I took out some money and I went, I found a producer, Jet Steiger, who I still work with. And he was the first person I worked with, and I still do. And mm-hmm. And I was like, I want to make this movie. And I said to Michaela, I was like, I wrote this. Michaela Watkins, mm-hmm. I was like, I wrote this for you, because I was obsessed yeah. with her. And we're friends. And I directed that, and that went to Sundance, and that, you know, yeah. won awards. And it started, you know, it satiated something in me, which was like, yes, you can do it. You're okay. You're good. And mm-hmm. by the way, not only can you do it, you love it. You yeah. know, it was like, oh, shit.
And so it proved it to yourself and to other people on the yeah. outside, too, probably, who said, okay, now
they were like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
And that became kind of like a visual and tonal calling card mm-hmm. for in the world. Because yeah. then I was like, this is the mm-hmm. tone. This is the pocket. This is what visually I want to do. And then, so for financiers and stuff, I could mm-hmm. say, here's what it is. This is the star, Lake Bell. Mm-hmm. I'm standing right in front of you. Mm-hmm. And so this is kind of what the package is. And so when I made that short film, just to get back to your question, my friends, you know, Cordry and all, and John Stern and David Wayne of, you know, the kind of makers of Children's Hospital team were like, we love this. Would you direct Children's Hospital? And then so I started directing Children's Hospital for a few seasons, you know, just mm-hmm. Two episode blocks and things like that. So yeah. that was like, you know, my sort of second acting gig. And then I was prepping on In a World. And I was like, I want Michaela in a World. I want Rob Corddry yeah, in a World.
You've got everyone in that movie. Yeah. yeah. It's so I love that movie so much.
Thank you.
And I had seen it in the theaters, and then I hadn't seen it until I rewatched it yesterday. Which was really fun to kind of revisit it. And so, yeah, I definitely want to talk about that. Where did that story come from, and why was that something that you wanted to tell?
I was obsessed with accents and dialects my whole life. It was mm-hmm. a huge part of what I thought an actor was, you know, and especially in my training and everything, you know, in England, early on, I thought like, oh man, like accents and dialects and languages for that matter were like a gateway into magical places. You know, it's like you could be anyone, you know, mm-hmm. and it was very intoxicating to think like, ooh, you know, especially in voiceover, you know, you're not judged by how you look or, you know, mm-hmm. how tall you are, how thin you are, how whatever, your ethnicity, your gender for that matter. Like mm-hmm. you could be a dude, you could be like anything, yeah. you could be an animal, you know, it's like mm-hmm. voiceover was so freeing. It was like the ultimate version of acting, you mm-hmm. know, and storytelling. So I think I became obsessed with it. And then also just, you know, I had my own sort of cultural sort of opinions about cultural and social opinions about where sort of the omniscient voice mm-hmm. was in our society as, mm-hmm. you know, at large, where you have like, why is it that there's no female voices who kind of are the voice of God? You know, mm-hmm. it's like, what's up with that? You know, yeah. and so that was just something that I, you know, became obsessed with. And then I thought that very much echoed a sort of bone I had to pick with my lady comrades about this sort of trend in the sort of affectation that was kind of plaguing our gender.
Over the next 6 weeks, Lewis will be recording your voices, and we will listen to your sounds evolve right before your very ears. Because women should sound like women, not baby dolls who end everything in a question. Let's make a statement.
There is a, you know, there's like this thing, this affectation that they were putting on as if to say, like, I'm a child, so I'm sexy? And I'm like, what? Like, what is that? And I, you know, I was obsessed with women I would meet who had big girl voices. You know, I was like, oh, that's... that feels like, oh, you're aging with grace or something. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, why are we trying to put this like kind of quasi childlike sexy baby thing? Mm-hmm.
Is it something you encountered either like on auditions or on in projects?
Life. I mean, it was, you know, during that time, you know, even just coming up in Hollywood, it was like, you know, it was like Paris Hilton was mm-hmm. the rage, you know, mm-hmm. and that there was like a whole kind of trend in that culture and you know, vibe, you know, so that was, you know, it was like really, you know, it was diminutive, you know, mm-hmm. and I was like, well, it was a feminist issue for me, because yeah. I just felt like as you grow up, your voice grows with you, you know, so mm-hmm. that would be normal, you know, and I remember thinking like Lauren Bacall back in the day, it's like she was like fucking 24 and she was mm-hmm. like, you know how to whistle. I mean, she had like mm-hmm. the sexiest, lowest yeah. voice, and you were like, I need to make out with you, you know, like, but you don't sound like a little girl. Like, why yeah. do you want to smooch a little girl? What? Like, it just felt like an issue. And so I felt that there was a lot to say in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
And so In a World was definitely a space where I could express all those things.
Yeah. I mean, the movie is a lot about sexism in the voiceover industry,
yes, for sure.
But also feels like a parable sort of for the larger sexism in Hollywood. And it's
yeah.
the movie's only, you know, 6 years old, but it's pre-Me Too, and it's a lot has happened since the movie came out.
Yeah.
Do you feel like you've seen changes in the industry at large in those 6 years?
I mean, 1,000%. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that, you know, it was a very sort of, at the time of In a World, it was kind of like, oh my God, like that's a conversation we're not like fully having. Mm-hmm. And I was sort of shocked by it. I guess I sort of thought, yeah, I'm going to talk about some, you know, sort of social politics and things like that. But I was actually surprised at the reaction from it. Mm-hmm. Just, you know, Gina Davis's speech, you know, about kind of this like quasi double standard about like, I'm going to hire you not because you're the best for the job, but because I want young women to see themselves as an authority and to be the voice of, you know, mm-hmm. the next generation. It was like, those were things I was trying to wrestle with, which I was like, oh, that is interesting. And what is it with women, you know, having trouble kind of lending a hand? You know, they're like, damn it, I got here on my own. You mm-hmm. do it too. You yeah. know, whoa.
It's so interesting that it's Gina Davis too, because she's become yeah. such a leader in terms of, you know, pay equity in Hollywood mm-hmm. and all this stuff. Were those conversations
she was at
that
the
you,
time,
you
yeah.
had about with her at that time? Or
it was. I didn't know when I cast her, when I asked her to mm-hmm. do it. I found out very shortly after, you know, talking to her, she said, you know, this is like really, this is like mm-hmm. pinpoints exactly what I am working towards. And so it was just built in and a really interesting conversation for her, but also resonated in layered ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. A sillier question about the movie that occurred to me when I was watching yesterday. Is there a story behind Ken Marino kissing your nose?
there is. Yes. So Ken, obviously, and I were on Children's Hospital together for many years. Mm-hmm. And when we did the movie, you know, I asked him to come and play Gustav, and he was super jazzed, and we had a great time doing it. And he was like, you know, before the makeout scene, he was kind of like, you know, I was like, hey, man, I was like, this is weird because we're like friends, but I think we have to like kind of go for it, you know, and I think Gustav you have to feel like Gustav is like sexy and like, mm. you know, like it's complicated, you know, he's like, you're annoyed with him and you hate him, but you also kind of like get it, you mm. know, like that she would sleep with him. And he was like, yeah, about that. I have a question, that, you know, I just have a pitch. I just want to throw it out there. And he was like, is it okay if I put my mouth around your nose? And like, I was like, what do you mean? Like suck my nose? And he was like, yeah, is that okay? Or, and I was like, yeah, man. Yeah, for sure. And he, and so we like, we start shooting and he goes for it. And we did a one take and I was like, okay. First of all, it's a genius fucking thing that you've just done. And I was like, I think the key here to this, Ken, is you have to do it twice. Because what's going to happen is you're going to do it and it's going to be like, did he just... Did I see that right?
Yeah.
And so I was like, I think let's work together here. I think I need you to do it again after you do it so that we can all go, yeah, he fucking meant to do that. You know? And so it was really fun. It was like a fun collaborative nose-sucking thing.
So you directed that movie. You obviously directed another movie after that since then.
I do until I don't.
And you're directing on Bless This Mess. And are there... Are there sort of dream directing projects in your head that you're wanting to do, or genres, or just in general, like what are the things that you want to do?
Yeah, I mean, it's forever. I'm forever obsessed. You know, it's like once you are a part of, I don't know. I love to direct so much. I do the magic of like, and I love writing things and having them come to fruition and like building the team to, you know, it's like the whole kind of community of it and the kind of kinetic energy of assembling this team. And then we're going to go forth and we're going to, you know, wear comfortable shoes and wear fanny packs and get this shit done. You know, it's like that part of it is infectious and I will forever do it. The project, that, I mean, I Do Until I Don't was... crazy. It was the first time I had directed with, first of all, seven main characters and having babies. You know, I had a baby for the first time and I was like, whoa, okay. You know, it's a really different experience. And I had Bless This Mess in a way is just in terms of writing is definitely an extension of my conversation and thoughts about marriage, which I have lots of complicated thoughts about. And I think it will be a forever discussion because marriage is totally crazy and worthy of, you know, continued creative discussion. I have a myriad of projects, you know, especially when I'm working on something, you know, like I was telling you, I wrote In a World while I was working on How to Make It in America. I tend to, and like kind of, if you want to get anything done, you ask a busy person, you know, it's like I multitask and it is part of who I am and I rev at a high RPM and like I have a ton of projects that I'm courting or that I'm have different in various states of ready, you know, in development. But I think that the coolest part of doing what we do is being able to participate in multiple types of genres. You know, it's like I don't want to do the same thing. You know. And I think that in different mediums and different platforms, because it is cool. We have a lot of different options these days where you can access people in different ways. And I'm really, you know, I was overwhelmed with it before where I was kind of like, oh, man, like how can I'm like a conservator, you know, I'm trained in a conservatory and like all of a sudden I might lose a role because this person has X amount of million followers on Instagram. You know, that was when I was coming up. I started to feel like, oh, you know, but then as a director, I'm like, oh, I love that guy. You know, it's like, or I love that gal. She's so funny. I watch her on Instagram and I love her and I've cast people from Instagram now, you know. So I think it's exciting to be in a time like that where people can be very sort of on the front foot of their own careers and destinies. And when people ask for advice and things like that, I'm like, I know that you people have the ability to just generate content and you can do it. But it takes effort, you know.
Coming up, Lake tells the story of how she tried and ultimately failed to improvise with Meryl Streep on the set of the movie It's Complicated. So what I want to do now is kind of run through a few of things from your career that we didn't get to talk about. And if there's a sort of story or memory that pops out about it. So I believe your first TV role was on ER.
Oh,
is
yeah.
Is that correct?
That is very true.
What do you remember from that experience?
That was literally the first thing I got cast in. I thought I have made it. I happened to be cast in the one episode that they took to Chicago. It was very cool. I got to see Chicago. I thought, this is like, I'm fancy. Okay. I think I was 22. And I remember it was a big, long Steadicam shot where it was like one of those opening shots. It was my first scene out of the gate in Hollywood was this big ER, like long, I think it was like 2 minutes long or something of just like, the gurney comes in, you know, the steady's following it, and then you hit to this, and this person passes off, and this extra runs through, and then da-da-da, and then the camera follows and pans and then lands on me. and I have to throw up off camera. So I had to hold like pea soup in my mouth for like 2 minutes until it landed on me. And then I had to be like, oh, well, and then so that was like my
That's a lot of pressure to be the end of one of those.
Oh, my God. I was so scared. I was so scared. Yeah.
So the next thing I want to talk about, which is very important to me because it is my wife's absolute favorite movie of all time, is It's Complicated.
Okay. Sure.
She tells people it's The Graduate, but it's actually It's Complicated.
So. Oh, okay. Fair news.
But I love the movie as well. And because it's her favorite, I've seen it many, many times.
Yeah.
And so that movie, you get to act opposite Meryl Streep.
Yeah.
You get to dance with Steve Martin.
Yeah, I mean, listen.
You're married to Alec Baldwin. There's a lot going on.
A lot of heavy hitters. Listen, yeah. That was my first day of shooting that. And it's like Nancy Meyer. I mean, the whole thing was just a lot of like, I was like in the deep end. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I got on set and my first scene out of the gate in that movie was the one where Meryl and Steve are high on marijuana.
Great scene.
Yeah. And there's me and Alec, and I'm supposed to kind of exude this high status as Agnes and kind of look down my nose at Meryl fucking Streep. And I was I couldn't be a bigger super fan. Like, we all are, right? Like, for fucking sake, like, she should run for president. The point is, she's fantastic. She's so not, it's like we all know, not only is she just like the most incredible, accomplished actress, but she's just also like a phenomenal human and makes the world a better place. So anyway, I got there and I knew my lines, but I also, you know, in the audition, Nancy had me improvise quite a lot. Mm-hmm. So I was like, oh, okay, cool. So I'm like here to kind of do some of that. I get it. So I was in rehearsal with Meryl and all of them. I was doing my lines, but I was improvising because I really thought that's what I was meant to do per my audition. So I was improvising and people were kicking things back. And, you know, the script supervisor came over to me and she was like, hey, so I just want to look at and I want to show you the lines here. Just so you know, these are the actual lines. And I was like, oh, okay. I was just like improvising and like, because I thought, you know, just like throwing in some extra stuff. Should I not do that? And she was like, no. Yeah, we don't do that here. And I was like, okay. It was just like Meryl was sort of saying some stuff and I was saying some stuff back and I was like kind of enjoying that. And she was like, Meryl was improvising? Okay, I have to go tell her that we have to get on book. I was like, no, wait, stop. Come back here. I am not tattletaling on Meryl.
Yeah.
I'm saying that she said stuff and I wanted to say stuff back, but we don't have to do that. Please don't go over there, please. And so, you know, that was kind of my first day. And then I got in there and I said the word perfect, but that was scary and I didn't know. And everybody who has worked with Nancy Meyers will know that she is word perfect. I didn't know that because in my audition it was different. So I learned that really quickly. Yeah. And
improvisation got into the movie.
She's just not. That's not like the vibe of that type of. I do a lot of comedy that's exactly what you're supposed to do.
Yeah.
And in Nancy Meyers, she likes it almost like a play. Mm-hmm. You know.
Yeah.
And so, anyway, so and at some point, you know, then I got kind of in my head about it. And then I was just like, oh, my God, I'm talking to Meryl Streep, you know, and then I just and Nancy Meyers had to pull me aside. And she was like, hey, snap out of it. Get it together. And I was like, yeah. No, I hear you. I'm just she's like, get it together. I was like, OK, cool. So then I like went back and then finally you like slapped myself in the face. And I was like, OK, high status, you know, and then I got through the scene.
By the way, how great is this party? Great. Let's be the last to leave.
Okay.
Hey, there's your ex-husband.
It's headed right toward us. Not a great time to be feeling groovy. Oh. Why so intense, big fella?
Hello, Jane.
Hi. Hey. Adam, good to see you again.
Hi. Adam, this is Agnes, Jake's wife.
Hi.
Hey. Oh, that's a such an odd sentence for me to say, since that was me for most of my life. I mean, seriously, how weird is that? Both of us married to the same man.
Hey, what are you gonna do?
Why go there?
Because there is fascinating. I mean, if you think about it, it sort of links us in a sort of cosmic, crazy way. Doesn't it, Agnes? I mean, of all the men on the planet, we both said I do to this guy.
Yeah, 25 years apart. I know you are having, like, an aha moment, but I think I'm going to get a refill. Adam, good meeting you.
Great meeting you.
And then I ended up really, like, you know, I Meryl was obviously very gracious and very cool, and she's very used to people feeling that way. And I got through the movie, and then, you know, later on, I know her daughters, and then I ended up presenting an award for her. Like, they asked me to present an award for her at this event, and I was like, you know, so then I, like, kind of grew up a little bit about it, and I was like, yeah, just, you know, I know Meryl's good.
Was she nice on the set? Because I know there's stories, like, in Devil Wears Prada, she's, like, very in character, and, like, not,
oh,
like,
she's, like,
but, and she, and you and her character are kind of at odds in the movie, so I wasn't sure.
Oh, no, she was phenomenal. She was, like, yeah, there was no... You know, she's like a consummate professional. I'm sure I don't know anyone who had worked on Devil Wears Prada, but I think that, you know, I think we can all just say that, like, Meryl, like, I have no complaints with Meryl.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the other thing I wanted to ask you about is the Wet Hot American Summer reboot, which was so much fun. And you get to play opposite David Wayne, his Israeli counselor in that, which is really fun.
I mean, David and I are like, we're like family at this point.
So what was it like to, because you hadn't been in the original, so what was it like to kind of go into this world?
I did both Wet Hot American Summer series reboots, and David is, you know, I was part of the children's hospital world. So at this point, like, we all kind of were putting each other in each other's stuff, or having everyone's directing everybody's stuff, you know, and it felt like family, you know. So when they asked me to be a part of it, I was super jazzed, because I did love What Happened American Summer. And I love the idea of the reboot. And I was pregnant for both. No, I had just had my baby for the first one. And then so I was, like, nursing for the first one. And then the second one, I'm actually pregnant when we're doing that, like, weird. There's, like, this weird kind of make out
threesome
thing, but like without, like, with cloaks and masks. It was so effed up. And I was like, pregnant. I was like, you guys are, this is insane. But, you know, it was really fun to do. And I think David and I really enjoy each other. So it's great. Like, anytime those guys say, hey, you want to, I'm like, sure, whatever it is. Like,
I love that David got to be in the series, since he you know, he directed the movie but wasn't in it.
I know. And he's so good. Yeah. He's so good.
So funny.
Yeah. He's just, he was in Children's Hospital too.
Yeah.
He played the rabbi. So. Mm.
So the way we end every episode is...
Rabbi McJewy is who he played. So, just for a fun fact.
So the way we end every episode is I ask the guests, what's the last piece of comedy that made you laugh really hard? So you can think of it kind of as a recommendation to listeners, as something they should check out that you thought was really funny.
Oh, shit. Well, you know, I'm a mama too. I'm going to shameless plug... No, I think that, if you haven't checked out Bless This, listen, if you haven't and you're like, I don't know, it's like network, I don't want to watch it, just fucking get your knickers out of a twist and give it a go, because it is legitimately, like, I think it's funny, okay? Mm-hmm. And so if you can just get through the fact that it's something, maybe you're not used to ingesting your comedy from a network space, give it a chance, because it is... made from the brains of a lot of the indie sort of alt comedy things that you do like. So you got to give it a chance.
Yeah.
Because I feel like Lennon alone, like, I just want to write for Lennon. You know, it's like Lennon is my, she makes me laugh.
Yeah, she's great.
She's great, and she's, like, very well used in the show, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, awesome. Well, thank you so much for doing this today. It was really fun talking to you.
Amen. Thank you very much. Namaste.
Thanks again to Lake Bell. You can watch Bless This Mess every Tuesday night at 8:30 p.m. on ABC. And if you haven't seen In a World, I definitely recommend checking that out as well. It's available on iTunes or Amazon or anywhere you rent movies online. And I'm really looking forward to whatever movie Lake ends up directing next. If you enjoy this show, please tell your friends and rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. You can find me on Twitter at Matt Wilstein and at thedailybeast.com. The Last Laugh is distributed by Himalaya Media for The Daily Beast. It is produced by Jason Smith and Scott Porch for Starburns Audio and edited by Mackenzie Mazel. Our theme music is by Claude, who you can find on Instagram at claude.mp3. You can find the show every week on Apple Podcasts, the Himalaya app, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And you can find show notes and highlights from each episode on thedailybeast.com. See you next week!